Welcome to Two Bits, a podcast about coins and currency, produced by the American Numismatic Association and hosted by Doug Mudd and Mitch Sanders. Doug, in this episode, we're going to continue our discussion of the Lincoln cent. This episode and the previous episode, they have a break point at a very natural break point, which is the first episode covered wheat cents, 1909 to 1958. And now we'll plan to cover the rest of the story, 1959 to the present. So each episode will stand on its own, but then taken together, they're a complete story or our complete discussion of the Lincoln cent.
Yeah, and it's been an interesting ride so far. We've covered some of the interesting aspects. And now what I find interesting is how the cent from 1959, when you have a major change, up until basically 1982, was fairly sedate. There wasn't a whole lot of change going on during that time frame, at least that people would notice. But after 1982, things speeded up, especially by the time we got to the 2000s and the bicentennial of Lincoln's birth and all that. So we've got a lot to talk about here, and I hope we'll be able to get into some other issues as well about design and how we go through these, because I know you've been involved in some very interesting aspects of design, particularly with the Lincoln cent.
There's a lot to the Lincoln cent story, and I agree that it after the initial change to the Lincoln Memorial, which we'll circle back and talk about, but it seemed to be pretty sedate. There were a lot of things going on that were not noticeable, and some things that almost happened that were pretty interesting to foreshadow a little bit. But the big change, of course, that prompts this breakpoint of 1909 to 1958, and then starting in 1959, is the new reverse for the Lincoln cent. So the Lincoln cent itself was introduced in 1909, for the centennial of Lincoln's birth. And then 50 years later, for the sesquicentennial of Lincoln's birth, it was decided to change the reverse. And the image that was chosen was an image of the Lincoln Memorial. Now, there's some cool drawings by Frank Gasparo, some of his original drawings and sketches for the design of the new reverse. And there are some other themes. There's a log cabin theme. There's more of a symbolic theme as opposed to showing a building of any kind. And we can put those in the show notes. But it was the Lincoln Memorial that was ultimately chosen. And so I want to ask your opinion about this, because I feel like there's often a lot of criticism of the Lincoln Memorial reverse. And I can see the point, but at the same time, I think it's a good rendition. I think the challenge is that a building like that is just hard to render on a coin. You know, it's a fundamentally a rectangular shape, so it can't fill the whole canvas of the coin. But, you know, to me, it looks like the Lincoln Memorial, and that's what it is intended to do. And so to me, it's artistically successful. But I know it comes in for a lot of criticism. What do you think about the Lincoln Memorial reverse and its artistry and its rendition?
Well, it's definitely a difficult building to render. I mean, yes, Greek temple-like buildings have been displayed on coins for many, many years. But the point of this is to really connect it with Lincoln. And I think they do a reasonably good job, because they do show Lincoln between the two columns at the center. But it is so small that it loses some of its impact. I mean, if I had to make a criticism, it would be only that if they could have enlarged the image somewhat, but there really isn't enough room. So, yeah. I mean, the only thing I can think of today would be, given the changes that have been made, new approaches to displaying portraits, for example, where you have Thomas Jefferson's head sort of peeking into the side of the nickel, and various changes like that. Perhaps a new way of modeling the memorial would be to show a close-up framed by the coin. So you cut off the wings and you show a close-up of the center where Lincoln's statue actually shows up between the two pillars in a reasonable size. But at this point with the union reverse, I think that's not going to happen anytime soon.
It's difficult to render the Lincoln Memorial, and I'm thinking by contrast of the $5 bill, right, where it's you know, it's a rectangular shape, like the Lincoln Memorial looks great on the $5 bill, and it lends itself very well to that type of design. I think a coin, it's just harder. And I do think the Lincoln Memorial is successful, but I have to recognize that it is difficult to portray a building in this way, especially when there's a small element that's important. And that's one interesting trivia question, or not trivia, but just general question about the Lincoln Cent, is that Lincoln actually appears on both sides of the Lincoln Memorial because his little tiny image is there, just like he would be in the memorial. You can't really make out his features. It's so tiny, but it's clearly there. And I think, you know, what else might have been done? You mentioned the close-up. Okay, you know, I think a close-up that could have been an interesting view. You could also consider looking at the memorial from an angle, like on the original Schlag version of Monticello on the 5-cent piece. It's sure. Coming at Monticello from the corner. But, you know, on the other hand, Monticello is like, it's a house. It's a much smaller building. And so maybe that lends itself better.
But that's the dome on the Monticello, I think, helps a little bit as well, just because it captures some of the roundness. But, I mean, given what it replaced, the wheat scent, you know, the two wheat ears weren't particularly exciting either. And they serve as a frame for something, but the frame was unimaginatively used around the words. So I think the Lincoln Memorial is a step forward. It's a compromise, but I think having it on the coin to me was a good choice, simply because the Lincoln Memorial was open to the public in 1923, I believe. And
22. I'm a devotee, so I know it's 22.
Okay. So, having a memorial dedicated to Lincoln, and especially a memorial like that, I mean, in real life, the Lincoln Memorial is extremely impressive. It's a wonderful building. Yeah. It's beautiful. And when you walk in and see the statue, it really has a huge impact. It's comparable to seeing some of the great works of art. You know, a few years ago, I went to Italy and I got to see the David. The David, and I'd forgotten the kind of impact you get when you see something that is a true masterpiece in real life. You know, I was awed, and you get that sense of awe when you see the Lincoln Memorial, and the statue just is so impressive, not simply by size, but just the design, the impact of it is there because it's so beautifully rendered, I guess is the way to put it.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm also thinking about the Lincoln Bicentennial Silver Dollar, which was issued only on a commemorative basis. And that shows a close-up of Daniel Chester French's statue of Lincoln from the Lincoln Memorial. And, you know, it's only on the statue, so you don't see the columns of the memorial. But that's definitely an impressive work of art. And actually, so this reminds me, this is what I'm about to say is outside the scope of a numismatic podcast, but I like to pass this along anytime I can. The Lincoln Memorial is just an amazing place to be. And something that I kind of discovered by accident, but now I do it more intentionally. If you go to the Lincoln Memorial as the sun is rising, you get a very different perspective on the interior, because you have the early morning kind of yellowish natural light, and then it's filtered through the columns, so you have these interesting shadows. You know, once the sun rises a little bit, then you know, you kind of see more of the interior light and the artificial light that's there. But in the morning, when you first see that sunlight on the Lincoln Memorial, it's really impressive. So I know we're about numismatics, not about travel tips, but if anyone has the chance, you have to wake up early, but to me, it's worth it. And if you want to bring a penny with you, Lincoln Memorial penny, for a numismatic component of the experience, that could be part of it too. That's something I try to do whenever I'm in Washington, D.C. It's just so interesting to see it at that time of day. But yeah, I feel like the Lincoln Memorial, it's critiqued. And, you know, I can see the basis for the critique, but I do think it's a very appealing coin, and it's a very successful coin because it conveys physically what it's intended to convey, and also conveys the importance of what it's intended to convey. And that's what we want a coin to do. And it's therefore successful, I think.
Yeah, I think it's been very successful, and it does relate very well. So it creates a whole with the obverse that I think is pleasing and creates a finished product that makes sense.
Yeah.
Unintended pun number one.
Makes sense. Good. Yeah, that may come up again. Interesting you make that point about the harmony of the coin, especially because the obverse and reverse are by two different designers. Like normally in the design process, it's changed lately with the rotating reverses, but normally you achieve that unity through the same artist designing both sides. But in this case, the art separated by 50 years, but they still have that harmony, as you described, from Lincoln on the front and then his memorial on the back.
Well, so once this was launched, the set continued on sedately, as I said before, and was still a major part of the numismatic world. But short of some interesting minor varieties and errors, there wasn't a lot going on for a while.
Yeah, there was 1960, a new decade. So you had a new digit in the date. And there were two different styles. There was the what they call the small date, where the six is kind of closely cropped. And then there's the large date, where the six, I don't know what you call it, but the uppermost part of the six comes up higher. And that was the version that was eventually used. It was hard to have a really tight numeral, just in terms of the production process. So you had these large date and small date varieties, which were really interesting at the time, and people still collect them. And it's interesting because it's a deliberate choice. It wasn't done by mistake. They just decided to change it in the middle of the year. One of the more interesting things I think that happened in the 60s was actually something that didn't happen, which was in the years 1965, 1966, and 1967, there were no mint marks on any United States coins struck with those dates due to the coin shortage that was instigated by the rise in silver prices, and the Lincoln cent was not implicated in that at all, being made of bronze, but a general coin shortage. So in that period, like including 1964 through 1967, the date on the coin did not necessarily match the year it was made, and the mint mark, there were no mint marks, so you could not distinguish between the products of Philadelphia, Denver, and San Francisco. So there's nothing to collect in that sense, but it's interesting that all mint marks were just totally suspended in that time, and dates were on coins, not necessarily reflective of when the coins were actually struck.
Which makes it interesting. I'm surprised that nobody has figured out some way of telling whether a coin was a Denver mint product or a Philadelphia mint product for the time. You know, there's always got to be some sort of diagnostics that could allow you to figure that out, but perhaps not.
That would be difficult. I'm not aware of anyone who's done it or even has tried.
Well, and is it true that the dies were still being produced by Philadelphia at that point and sent out, or?
The dies were all in Philadelphia. The only thing that occurs to me that might get you some leverage on this is that the special mint set coins were made in San Francisco. I don't know. That would depend on the same dies being used. And I don't know if that would have even happened. Like you couldn't even really establish a die progression like you often can with older 19th century coinages. So I don't know. There's an unsolved mystery of numismatics. Where were all these different coins made?
The only way you could do it is do die matching the pairs, and then whatever types don't cross over, so you don't see any dies and die pairs being crossed over to this other set of die pairs, maybe you could come up with a difference, but it'd be conjectural at best, probably.
Yeah, or if you could establish someone who got a roll of coins from the mint, directly from the mint, in 1965, maybe you could figure it out. Or, you know, got it from a bank in Philadelphia in 1965. Right. So you could have a presumption. That would be far more likely. You get it from a bank in Philadelphia or anywhere in the East. But then you'd have to, you know, maintain, like, still have to know which coins those were.
Right. Then you could create the baseline die matches to create this. But probably not worth it in this situation. Still. Yeah.
Interesting thought experiment, though.
Yeah. So one of the things you mentioned there is the whole idea of the rise in metal prices, silver rising and creating a problem with a coin shortage. But that eventually was going to affect the cent as well because of rising prices for metals in general. The fact that copper prices were rising would eventually cause a problem, which culminated in 1982.
Right. And that's a theme that is throughout American coinage history and continuing up until the present day, that coins have to be manufactured and have to be manufactured through a combination of materials and labor. And if the material costs get to be too high, then that becomes an issue. And for silver coins, it became an issue in 1964 and the years leading up to it. And then for the cent, it became an issue. Well, it was potentially an issue throughout to the point that in 1973, there was very serious thought given to switching the composition of the cent to aluminum. And in fact, over a million trial coins were made, dated 1974, made out of aluminum. There are a couple out there. One's in the Smithsonian. One is in private hands. They're not considered to be legal to own unless you are the Smithsonian. But the coins are out there, and that's an interesting chapter in what might have been, it ended up not happening. The immediate danger passed in 1973, so the 1974 aluminum cents never happened. But it was being very, very seriously considered, and the existence of these coins and a million more that were created is a testament to just how serious the prospect was.
Yeah, and I have a small connection with that because having worked at the Smithsonian, I handled the 1974 aluminum cent, and I also went through the paperwork because, very interestingly, the Secret Service has been involved in anti-counterfeiting measures for many, many years, mostly with paper money, but also with coins. And at one point, they were asking for examples of notes and coins from the Smithsonian collection that they apparently wanted to actually keep. And we, of course, said, wait a minute, you can't gut our collection. We're the official repository for the mint, and you can come here or, you know, we can cooperate with you, but we're not going to let you take the national treasure here. But part of that encouraged me to look up the background of the 1974 aluminum cent. And it turned out that when it came out, one of the congressmen that received one of these as an example of what might happen, and, you know, here's an example of the possible aluminum cent. They were very interested in coins themselves, the congressmen, and they were close friends with the Stefanellis, who ran the National Numismatic Collection at the time. So they sent the example of the 74 aluminum cent that they had to Dr. Clayne Stefanelli to add to the collection as an appropriate response, since the Smithsonian National Numismatic Collection was the repository for the mint. And apparently when they requested that all the aluminum cents that were sent out to congressmen be returned, the congressman said, well, we've given it to the Smithsonian, and the Secret Service sent a letter to Dr. Stefanelli and requested that the coin be returned. And he said, no, we are the proper place for this coin to be. And I guess through his connections and everything else, he ended up winning the argument. So the Smithsonian does have an example. But it was an interesting situation where you had different bureaus of the government in conflict. And in this case, luckily, the logical and correct solution, according to how I believe, was reached, and we were able to keep one. And as you said, there is at least one other, and maybe some others out there, but since they are illegal to own, you're not likely to see any of them anytime soon.
Yeah, that's a really interesting backstory, and for the fact that the right thing happened, but it just kind of happened. Like, it wasn't, I know at one time the Mint would send examples of coins or patterns or other things to the Smithsonian, would make a point of doing so. I don't know when that ceased, but it was not happening by 1974. But this piece of American history, this unique item, this 1974 aluminum cent, it belongs in the Smithsonian so that everyone can see it. I know when I go to Washington, D.C., I always go to the Smithsonian. I always see the National Numismatic Collection. And if I were there, if I only had like 1 minute to see one thing, I would go to see the 1974 aluminum cent. Now, fortunately, I'm never in there with only a minute to look around, but that's always the highlight for me, because it doesn't exist anywhere else, except for there's another specimen that's kind of dubious about its legality. But it's just such a unique item, and there's no other way to see it. So interesting on that basis.
Yeah, and as the collection manager, that was one of the things that I wondered about, because I know you're looking at, I mean, the U.S. Mint does give a selection of the products that they produce every year, including, at least while I was there, and I still think they're doing that, is different packaging for the same product. So if there's a two coin set, if it's packaged in two different ways, you'll get both packaging sets. But at some point, they were sending out patterns for U.S. Mint products, and that was something that was very interesting, because I think that is part of the back history that you can't get anywhere else. But they stopped doing that at some point, and I was never able to determine just why that happened. But it was unfortunate. We did have some interesting pieces. For example, there was a metals test set that was produced at one point using Martha Washington as the design.
Yes, I was going to mention that. I had the privilege of seeing that once. I was able to see that at the Smithsonian. And it was amazing to see, because there were many different experiments that were done, and to see them all. I think they were like in a coin album, you know, like with,
well, they were
at least when I saw them
in Cointain, sort of, not a Cointain, in a Capital Plastics holder sort of thing, right, almost. Right. And I believe the date was 1964, but I may be totally wrong. But there was titanium. There were a few other metals that were interesting. So different colors. It was a neat set.
Yeah, that's really cool. And as a collector, when I think about the National Numismatic Collection, what I want to see the weird stuff, like the annual proof sets and commemoratives. You know, I can go buy those, but it's the thing. It's like the aluminum send, the metal trial pieces that you just talked about, or like 1964 D piece dollar, or the 2000 West Point gold Sacagawea, like just the weird stuff that you can't see anywhere else. So I'm glad that the 74 aluminum cent is there and is on display, because I always make a point of seeing it. And that's another Washington, D.C. tourism recommendation. Go see the National Numismatic Collection and that coin in particular. But the reprieve was only brief, because by 1982, the issue was coming up again, where it was time to consider a change in the metal, and this time it actually did happen.
Yeah, and it happened for a good reason. Part of the whole point of making coinage is to create something that could be used by the people as money, but an important aspect of it has always been that the producer has always made at least enough to to reimburse themselves producing the money. So the cost of producing the money plus a little bit of extra for the paying the workers and all that kind of stuff, plus then seniorage. And seniorage has become, well, has always been a major part of producing money. The fact that when you produce it, you make enough extra to make a profit, the government can make a profit. In the last 100 years or so, the seniorage has increased considerably because you get things like paper money, where a dollar has much less than a dollar's worth of ink or paper on it, and the production costs are fairly low. And when you've moved away from bullion coinage, which the cent was never really considered bullion coinage, but when copper got to the point where I think today what a cent costs something like 4 cents to make, you have to really ask yourself, why are you producing it anymore?
Well, yeah, that so historically the challenge was to make sure that governments did not abuse this idea of seniorage, that they wouldn't inflate the currency and make, you know, quote, a profit on that basis. That's why coins were made of precious metal and why paper money was introduced only gradually, because if you can issue it without limit or with very little limit, then that poses all kinds of economic problems. The penny is the opposite problem, because its value is so small that the issue, if anything, is going to be the challenge of making it for less than 1 cent,
right?
Which eventually or by 1982 was no longer possible with the copper composition. So a change was made starting in 1982. The outward appearance of the penny is the same because it has an outer layer of copper, but now instead of being copper or bronze throughout, now it's the outer layer of copper, but inside is made of zinc. And there's continuation of the story, because this is still an issue, or has now become an issue again. But first I want to note just about the terminology and what it means. So I'm looking in the Red Book, and the modern cents are described as copper-plated zinc, so a core of zinc plated with copper. But then going back to the 1943 steel cent, the steel cents are described as zinc-coated steel. So contemporary cents are plated. The steel cents are coated. For whatever reason, I have a difficult time keeping these things straight. But the difference is that in the modern cent, the plated cent, the blank is entirely covered with a layer of copper. So, if you look on the rim, it still looks like it's copper. But if you look at the steel cent, which is indicated as being coated, then if you look at on the rim, it's like a sandwich. There's the zinc on top, and then you can see the steel, then you can see the additional thin layer of zinc. So I don't know, that was like 2 minutes about numismatic terminology, but I find it interesting that the new cents are plated, the steel cents were coated, and those do have different meanings in terms of how they're comprised.
Yeah, the technical side of coinage, which is often ignored by many collectors, the terminology actually does mean something specific. To get into it, a notorious example is, first strike coins. Well, that's only intended to be the very first strike, or perhaps you could be liberal about it and say the very first 5 or 10 strikes, but never how it's been marketed.
Right, you don't know which coins were struck when. You only know which coins were received first. Here's what confuses me: if I take a coated aspirin, then that is entirely coated. But then in numismatic terms, that activity or that description would be described as plated. So
right.
I don't know. I may be causing more confusion than resolving it. But what's ultimately interesting to me is that on modern cents, they are totally covered. Whereas steel cents, it's just like a thin layer on top, like a sandwich with a very thin thin layer of zinc on top of the steel. So,
and it's created a difference in some aspects of collecting, particularly if you are a elongated coin collector. You know, most elongates are made out of cents. And I find that among the older collectors, they prefer to use the pre-1982 coins because when you squish them in the elongate machine, you get an even copper color as opposed to the new cents, where you'll often get a large streak in the middle of the zinc showing through. Not always, but
quite often. Right. When you crush it, the layer is thin enough that you can expose some of the zinc. That's interesting. I think it's cool to see the elongated cents with the zinc streaks, or the zinc spots, however they turn out. But that's why there's so many different ways of collecting, because people have these different preferences. So 1982 to the present, we have had this copper-plated zinc composition. But I don't know when it happened, but sometime in the 21st century, it basically became the case that it was not going to be possible to produce a penny for less than 1 cent. Like, even if the material didn't cost anything, just the labor and the production and the capability, like just that by itself would cost more than a cent. So I don't think there's any presumption that the cost of making a cent will ever be less than 1 cent. It could still be less than what it currently is. And I know there've been experiments going on, at least some possibility of the composition changing, but then that always has to be balanced against, you know, if you change the composition to save some money, then cost some money to make those changes could impact the dyes, it could impact other elements of production. And then what if the prices recede again, then you now have this new apparatus for making coins with new metal that is not really needed. So, but then at the same time, you could always make that argument and then you never end up making a change. So I don't know. It's unclear what will happen, whether the cent's composition will change, may or may not. I have a feeling the cent will stick around despite the lack of economic soundness of its production, that it costs more to make than its base value. But that's one part of the cent story, the Lincoln cent story, that it's still unresolved even to this day. What will it be made of moving into the future?
So we get back to the cent and the change in the metal, which really didn't have a major impact on the popularity or otherwise of the cent.
Yeah, and you can delve in as deeply as you want to into the realm of dye varieties or mint mark varieties. There are a few prominent varieties listed in the Red Book. These, usually the double dyes, are the most dramatic, and those are listed. Like, there was a big double dye in 1969 from some San Francisco coins. Those are really rare. There was a 1972 double dye, pretty prominent, and rare, but not, it's still collectible. There were a few in the 80s, but then a big one in 1995, really substantial double dye in 1995, especially visible on Liberty, and those don't cost much at all, maybe like $30 to $50 for a nice specimen, and those got a lot of attention at the time.
Yeah, people are still looking for those, and it's a great sort of beginner landmark. You've made it into a serious collector of cents if you can get a 1995 double die to begin your journey further into it beyond the blue book stage.
It's a good entry level, and it's quite visible. Did you ever find one or know anyone who found one? I bought one, but I think there were like a million made, but that, you know, a million compared to billions of pennies every year and then over multiple years, it wouldn't be easy to find. But
right, I never found one. I don't know if anybody that did.
To be honest, I never looked that hard. I saw, like, I could buy one at a reasonable price, and I decided to do that instead. But it's a cool piece.
And with that, it's time to end this episode. And we'll pick up with the story of the Lincoln cent in the 21st century next time on 2 Bits.